From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A rise in domestic abuse is being reported around the world in connection with the global coronavirus shutdown. This past weekend, the Secretary General of the United Nations cited what he called a horrifying surge in these cases, and he urged governments to make domestic violence prevention a key part of their national response to COVID-19. Here in New Hampshire, advocates want victims to know they still have choices, even though it's admittedly harder to connect, find support, and a safe place. Toward that end, Governor Sununu recently announced $600,000 additional dollars devoted to the state's crisis centers. This hour in The Exchange, countering domestic abuse. How the work continues, even in the midst of a pandemic. Let's hear from you. Listeners, are you concerned about someone in your life during this time who might be facing abuse? What would be helpful for you to know? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Lynn Shillette, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Also, Scott Hampton, Director of Ending the Violence, which offers educational classes to offenders, applied research programs, training, and expert witness testimony. And also with us, Jennifer Pearson, Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire, which provides shelter and advocacy to victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And before we begin, listeners, if you or someone you know needs help, you can call New Hampshire's 24-hour domestic violence hotline at 866-644-3574. 866-644-3574. Someone will be there to answer your questions or connect you with resources. Any resources that we mention or phone numbers that we give out will also be at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So, Jennifer, to you first, please. When normal life as we knew it began to get smaller and smaller, closing schools, businesses, restaurants, no travel, no social distancing, no social gatherings, and on, what was the first thing that you thought about as someone who focuses on domestic violence? And Jennifer, go ahead.
So, yeah, so when the COVID started, is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, when this whole thing started happening a couple weeks ago, what did you think? What were you anticipating?
My instant thought was the isolation and victims being in the home with their abusers. I think all of us as advocates statewide, our thoughts immediately went to that place. And how is this going to impact the victims? How is this going to look for them being able to access services and their safety all around?
Yeah, similar to a lot of the issues we talked about in our earlier hour with kids. How about you, Lynn? What came to your mind as soon as you started seeing these orders coming down?
Hi, good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
What came to my mind is that this is such an important time for us to be talking about domestic violence. As you indicated in your opening, what we know in times of natural disasters in this country, such as after Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and even from the coronavirus in countries where it hit ahead of the United States, rates of domestic violence do increase. And I think what is important for folks to know is that these natural disasters and this pandemic don't cause domestic violence, but they do create a set of circumstances in which violence is more likely to happen. Someone who hasn't been violent in the past isn't likely to suddenly become violent. However, as Jennifer alluded to, abusers will take advantage of stressful situations to gain more control over victims. And I think what's most unusual and most ironic in this situation is the necessary response to the pandemic, that is staying home, is an action that will actually create more risk for domestic violence victims.
Well, it's probably an obvious question, but I'd love for you to just describe how that does create more risk. Just kind of walk us through that if you could, please.
Absolutely. So isolation is one of the most frequent tools used by abusers, and I'm going to guess Scott is going to be talking about that a little bit later. And unfortunately, now when we are asked to stay at home, that isolation becomes even more extreme, and it's exacerbated by other stressors, such as financial stressors. So perhaps the breadwinner in the home has lost their job, and now there are financial concerns. Most domestic violence relationships already involve financial abuse. So now a victim who's being abused is being asked to stay at home with none of the usual reprieves, for example, going to school or going to work, where someone might be able to say, help is available. Someone can listen to you and help you identify resources. So we have this perfect storm in a home where the stressors become so much more significant. And what we're hearing from victims is that they may have less opportunity to reach out for help. It may not be safe to pick up the phone. And I'd love to have an opportunity to talk about some of the things crisis centers are doing to make services available when victims aren't able to pick up a phone.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big theme, how people connect and get the help they need when everything is different and so much has migrated online. But Scott, I want to bring you in too. Part of your work is with offenders. I'm interested to hear your perspective on the idea that with everything shut down, perpetrators have been provided an easier opportunity to be abusive and get away with it. So what are your thoughts on that, Scott?
Well, when I think about the work with abusers, I always start off with the questions, why do they abuse? And I think it's helpful to understand that we toss around this phrase that's about power and control, but we don't always sort of spell that out. And what it means is that someone abuses their power in an attempt to control someone else. The reason they do that is because they're feeling out of control in their own lives. And there are two ways that people can deal with being out of control. One is we can take responsibility and figure out, what do I need to do to make my life better? The other approach, which is what abusers adopt, is rather than taking responsibility, I'm looking for someone to blame. I'm looking for someone or something to project my problems onto so that I don't have to own this. So when I look at situations like the pandemic, the question I ask is, what effect does this have on an abuser's inclination and opportunity to abuse? And when I think about the pandemic and our response to it, well, the inclination, when they go through the financial stress, as Lynn was talking about, the social isolation, that increases their inclination because they're having a really, really hard time. The opportunity to abuse, well, now she's locked up in the house with him. I asked a man in my program as this was starting to take shape, And I said, you know, what's this like for you to have the pandemic here? And he said, well, it's about time. I'm sick of being the one who's always locked up. Let's see how she likes it. And so they're thinking about the how much easier it is for them to control their partners, and viewing this as an opportunity to maintain control of their family members.
Well, and Scott, just briefly remind us of the work that you do, because it's unusual and you're providing a window into how abusers think that we sometimes don't hear about.
Right. So while the work that Lynn and Jen do is focused primarily on working directly with the victims, I work directly with the perpetrators. But I should say up front that I also see myself as a victim advocate. And what I mean by that is that if I don't always keep first and foremost in my mind the safety of victims, I shouldn't be doing this work. So I work directly with the perpetrators. They come in for a group session, and we talk about ways that they can go about getting their needs met in their lives that do not involve causing problems for themselves or for other people. In other words, how do they lead a non-abusive lifestyle? How do they develop healthy relationships? So it's basically a group format where we develop this sort of counterculture, counter to the ever so present misogyny and sexism and homophobia and racism, all of those problems in society. We try to create an environment where men can talk about healthier ways, sort of a reconstructing what masculinity is all about.
Wow. This hour, we are looking at adults facing domestic abuse and how complicated it can be to help them. Given that, as we're hearing, much of normal life is shut down right now, giving abusers an easier opportunity to do what they do. Listeners, if you are concerned about someone in your life during this pandemic, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What would be helpful for you to know, again, if there's someone that you care about and that you're worried about during this time of societal shutdown? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, our phone number is 1-800 800-892-6477. Our guests are Lynn Cholette, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, Scott Hampton, Director of Ending the Violence, based in Dover, but he works statewide, and Jennifer Pearson, Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire, which maintains a shelter and also works on advocacy to victims and survivors. And Jennifer, to you, what have the calls been like to your shelter?
Our calls are actually really decreased since all of this started. On average, our advocates take around 30 to 40 calls a day. And right now, they are fielding about 8 to 10 calls a day. And that's simply because victims don't have access to make those calls. As Lynn was alluding to, they are in the homes without that reprieve of going to work, going to school. They're not able to pick up the phone and call us and have a conversation about what's going on. And in the midst of all of this, we have worked really thoughtfully but quickly with the coalition and all of the sister programs throughout the state to implement some new technology to make it easier for victims and survivors to access us without making a phone call. So we have rolled out online chat services and texting as well so that victims have a safer way without picking up the phone and calling.
Sure, it'd be hard if you're stuck with your abuser all day long.
Absolutely.
To make a private phone call. Now, give us those numbers again, Jennifer, because those are important, how much your calls have gone down.
Yeah, so on average, we take about 30 to 40 calls a day, and right now we're down to about 8 to 10 calls.
Wow. And yeah. Toward that end, in terms of, you know, texts or messaging, I know that there has been some concern around telehealth, people getting mental health counseling, for example, online and so mm-hmm. forth, about security. What about those communications, Jennifer, online? Clearly, you need to reach people and connect with people, but how do you keep those connections secure?
Sure. So we are working with a company that has specifically designed based around our confidentiality. So the technology itself is secure and also allows a quick escape. So if the victim's abuser does walk in the room, they can escape out and it takes them to a Google homepage. So all of that is secure. The only factor that may come into play is if somebody has put spyware or malware onto their device.
Yeah. Sometimes it is pretty easy to track people's online histories. Go ahead, Jen.
We do give a disclosure. So whenever somebody does chat or text us, they get an automatic message that if they believe that somebody had access to install spyware, not to use that service.
Interesting. Could you jump in on that as well, Lynn? How, you know, you can't really make a traditional call if your abuser is in the next room or in the same room. How different crisis centers and shelters around the state are trying to transition to online support?
Absolutely. So the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire is really one of the leaders in adopting some of this technology. And at the same time, we are in conversations with colleagues around the country who are doing the same thing, because the whole country is obviously being impacted by this crisis at once. So we are looking at more innovative forms of technology that do reflect what people are already using, as you indicated, for telehealth. We're also really trying to give guidelines both to crisis center staff and to victims who are reaching out for help about really basic ways to maintain your own privacy at home. It might mean that you have to take a phone call sitting in your car. It might mean that while your kids play outside, you can take a more confidential phone call inside. So we're still focused on that really core philosophy of providing services in the way that victims need, while also working to protect their confidentiality.
And how secure are some of these networks that people are using?
Yeah, as Jen indicated, our national partners have been working with many of the manufacturers of these programs, which have really been set up to ensure that private and confidential communications can happen between a victim and a trained advocate at a crisis center. It is important, however, though, that people know what's on their devices and that there isn't anything that could be tracking their communications.
Well, got an email from Emily. And again, Emily, thank you for writing. Emily says, I was wondering about the issue that an abusive partner or ex-partner might leverage COVID-19 fear to keep from returning the child as part of a court order. An abuser could certainly try to use that to maintain control or punish the non-offending parent. And Scott, I'll throw that to you first. You mentioned isolation is a tool for abusers. They can take that opportunity. What about using fears of coronavirus as another opportunity to maintain that power and control?
Yeah, when we're talking about social isolation, we think about the tactics that are available to abusers. A lot of times people say, well, it's domestic violence. What you're really talking about is just about a bunch of wife beaters, and that it's really all about physical violence. There actually are 16 different kinds of abuse. I'm not going to go through the entire list, but I asked the men in my group, I do this periodically, if you had to give up one of your tactics, the physical, psychological, emotional, social, different tactics, which one would you give up? And they tell me that the one they would give up most readily is the physical, which seemed odd because it seems so effective. But the reason is the physical is what gets them caught. It's what leaves evidence. And what they're more likely to do is to use other tactics of control. And one of the greatest areas is the social isolation. So what I've heard many abusers tell me is they say, my job is to make her more dependent on me than I am on her. So if I can, because if she needs me more than I need her, I don't have to worry about her leaving me. So they try to push away all of the social supports, whether it's family, whether it's friends, whether it's coworkers. And so if you look at the effect of COVID on this, if his goal is to socially isolate her, he doesn't have to do any work. I want her to stay away from the coworkers. Done. She can't go to work. I want to keep away from her family and friends. Done. They have to be isolated somewhere else. We're not allowed to go visit them. So the pandemic in some ways has been the ultimate ally for abusers. And in some ways, it's pushing us back about half a century. When in the 1970s, we were just opening the door. It used to be domestic violence used to be this private matter where it was no one else's business. We opened the door and allowed the community in to say, no, this is a public health matter all of its own. And now with COVID, we've slammed the door shut again. Now we said that stay away order that you might get from the courts, that's being superseded by the stay at home order being issued by the governor in response to the pandemic. So for a lot of abusers, COVID's working quite nicely.
Wow, it's so sad and profound to hear you say that, Scott, that the pandemic is doing the work that abusers normally would have to do themselves. That's so sad.
It's in some ways, the pandemic is the ultimate appeals court.
You know, getting on the tools that abusers use, and to Emily's email, what about children, Scott? How often are those used also as a tool of, you know, if you come forward with these allegations, you know, I'll keep the kids?
Yeah. One of the hats that I wear is I run a supervised visitation center where parents come in and they use the center because it's unsafe to exchange the kids outside of there because of some domestic violence or other form of abuse. So there's something that I sometimes refer to as the victim blame sandwich, which has always been in effect. And it goes something like this. If a parent is vulnerable to the other parent and but stays in the relationship with kids there, she might get blamed for failure to protect the kids. Okay, so now she leaves, but if she's hesitant then to turn around and exchange the kids or give the kids to the other parent, she's hesitant because of fear for their safety, she's now accused of parental alienation. So she's damned if you do, damned if you don't. In a current environment with COVID, there courts have been hearing some concerns. I just heard about this yesterday, where one of the parents said, my co-parent works at a retail establishment. That's a dangerous place because of all the exposure to the virus. She's not protecting the kids very well. So here we go, failure to protect again. Then if she is hesitant to send the kids on over to the other parent for exactly the same reason, then she gets accused of custodial interference. So the kids have become a very convenient weapon. And what we need to try to do at a visitation center and other places is find creative ways to maintain the parent-child contact without further jeopardizing the safety of either the parents or the children.
Yeah, we talked earlier in our earlier hour about conflicts between parents, about how seriously one household is taking the coronavirus versus another household, and that does seem to be causing a lot of issues and is being used in some instances, as you say, Scott, as a way of control. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we will take more of your calls and emails. Emily, thank you for that one. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And coming up, we'll hear more about how services for domestic abuse victims have had to change and whether they can be as effective. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, adults facing domestic abuse and how complicated it can be to help them, given that much of normal life is shut down right now. Listeners, are you concerned about someone in your own life during this pandemic? What would be helpful for you to know so that you can help that person? Let's hear from you. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Lynn Chalette, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, Scott Hampton, Director of Ending the Violence, and Jennifer Pearson, Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire, which provides shelter and advocacy to victims and survivors. And Jennifer, I did want to ask about the status of your shelter right now. Are you still able to provide emergency support?
We are. We were at capacity prior to COVID, and we are still housing those folks that are in shelter. So we are fully up and running, and our challenge right now is what to do when we get shelter calls. And I think that is pretty common across the state.
So you're full, Jennifer, right now. You can't take in new people? Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Wow. So what are you doing when someone calls and says help and you don't have any room?
We do have, thanks to Governor Sununu issuing that $600,000, we do have the ability to hotel people that are in imminent danger. We are working around the issue of hotels being closed. When he did the shutdown of hotels, Airbnbs, and rentals, Governor Sununu did say that the folks that would be exempted from that were medical health professionals and domestic violence victims. So he has worked really closely with the coalition and Lynn's team to make sure that these victims are protected in this time where they are at a heightened level of danger.
Well, and Lynn, I want to ask you about that too, but first go to our listeners. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And from Manchester, Rashida is calling in. Hi, Rashida. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to appreciate all the service that the Crisis Service and the coalitions are doing, and Scott too. I wanted to add that we are at the police department. We're still receiving calls. The officers are still going to domestic violence calls. And we have 37 cases since the court is closed that are been waiting for the court to be open on May 4th, hopefully. The police department are still doing services. The officers out there are going for the calls every time, every minute that receive a call for domestic violence, regardless of if it's a criminal case or just a complaint of disagreement between partners.
Wow. So, Rashida, you're a police officer in Manchester.
And I am not. I'm an advocate with the domestic violence unit. Sorry.
I see. Okay. It's great that you called. So you're seeing a continuation of calls, Rashida, or a drop-off that some of our other guests have mentioned?
We are seeing a continuation of calls. Right. We still, I just got the stats today. So for simple assault, we have 191 cases. Last year, we had 167. For second degree, we had 22 cases. Last year, we had 19. for first degree, we had one. Last year we had zero. For a violation of protective order, we have 18. Last year we had 14. For stalking, we had 62 last year, and we have 54 this year. For domestic, no crime, which those the ones are mostly I'm concerned about. We have 271, and last year we had 240. And domestic, no crimes, that's when the officers goes to the call and the victim does not disclose there is physical activity there and will say, we just were loud, we have stress, we are have a disagreement on personal issues, but there is no crime activity that's happening.
Wow, Rashida, so I'm so glad you called. Is there anything else that you want to just share with our listeners, given again that you work on this issue with the Manchester Police Department? Just anything you want people to know or to think about, especially in this time, Rashida?
We are still open for business, if we can say that. We are still receiving calls. Our officers are trained, are trauma-informed, and they go to the call 24/7. And not just in Manchester, I'm going to assume in all New Hampshire.
All right. Rashida, thank you very much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, the number is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Lynn, we heard from Jennifer a moment ago about her shelter and how if there's no room at her shelter, thanks to the governor's new funding, she's able to find hotel rooms for people. What are you hearing from other shelter operators around the state, Lynn?
So the governor has issued three executive orders that impact victims of domestic and sexual violence. And Jen referenced the first one, which does include $600,000 in funding. That's broken into three categories. The first category is funding for immediate expenses that victims may have, especially victims who are fleeing, but maybe not. Expenses like rent, groceries, transportation, paying a phone bill, basic costs that will help them stay safe. The second category is the one Jen referred to, which is short-term lodging, probably at a hotel. Historically, some of our programs have been able to use rental cabins or other places like that. And the third category of funding is funding to help the crisis centers keep their doors open. Like so many nonprofits in New Hampshire, all of our programs are going to experience a significant drop in privately fundraised dollars in the next several months, as we've had to cancel so many events at which people come together and contribute resources toward the crisis centers. So we are quickly working with the governor's office to help identify those locations that would be available for safe lodging under his second executive order. And we are going to work very quickly to get this funding out to the crisis centers because these are immediate costs. These are costs that victims have right now and needs they have right now to stay safe. A perfect example would be we've heard from a couple of programs where abusers are about to be released from jail and would be coming back into the home, and the victim is very fearful and needs to get out of the home to stay safe and needs lodging immediately.
So give us a little bit more on that, because I have seen some of that in the news. So people have done their time behind bars for domestic violence crimes. They're about to be released, and the victim feels as if, you know, they have nowhere to go.
There's kind of two issues here, Laura. That is one of them, in that individual cases that have naturally worked their way through the system may be coming up and an abuser's release is scheduled. Probably the bigger concern we have is that there have been significant requests to release mass amounts of folks who are incarcerated based on them being medically fragile or more at risk for contracting COVID-19. The significant concern we have here is that it is really vital for the Department of Corrections or local jails or the courts to be balancing safety issues for victims whenever that issue comes before them. Because if a domestic violence offender is released back into the community or back into the home where he or she was battering the person they were living with, we suddenly have a huge additional safety risk for that victim. So it's really important that the decision makers not make just blanket decisions about releasing individuals, but instead really weigh the circumstances in these cases. One of the cases that did get a lot of press this week in Carroll County involved someone who was convicted of domestic violence that involved firearms. The focus of the hearing was the offender's request to be released based on his medical fragility. And there was also significant discussion during the hearing about his interest in getting his firearms back. The victim made a very public statement about being very, very fearful. So it's critical that these issues are considered and weighed by the courts before offenders are released back into their communities and their homes.
Well, I want to ask all of you about firearms a little bit later, background checks and so forth, given that we are seeing this rise in domestic violence. But I would love to share this email that just came in with you. This person did not want to give his name. He says, I live in Keene and have been emotionally abused by my now ex-wife for about 7 years. We have a 50-50 parenting arrangement, and I want to share that she has attempted to keep the children due to, quote, fears of coronavirus within my household. This person says, this show is really resonating with me, unfortunately. I also want to point out that it's not only men who are the abusers. And that's an important point, and I want to thank the person for writing in. And Scott, to you first, is there anything in this email that you want to address? It's an important point.
Yeah, I think it's a very important email for a couple of things. One, he underscored the, two things. One was that domestic violence doesn't know any gender, racial, age limits. Abuse can go any direction. So anyone can be abusive towards another. And as I was mentioning before, the physical abuse is not the only kind of abuse out there, that sometimes the emotional or psychological abuse can be just as common. It can be just as harmful. And he also underscored the role of children in that one of the things that I think we as a system need to do is to be able to focus on both priorities, the importance of parent-child relationships and the importance of the safety of everyone involved. What's really in some ways challenging about COVID is that in some ways this is brand new for us. You know, we've never seen this particular kind of public health crisis. On the other hand, it's also very familiar. And I think one of the opportunities that this situation gives us is it helps us to understand what it's like to feel unsafe. I've never felt unsafe in a relationship, but I do feel unsafe if I go to the grocery store. And I think one of the things that domestic violence victims have known for so long is about what that's like to never feel completely safe in their environment. And now all of society is getting a little taste of that to say, this is what it's like when you don't know if you or the people around you are going to get sick, if they're going to die, if everyone's going to be safe. And I think that glimpse into what it's like to be in danger, I think will be helpful for all of us as we think about how it is that we offer services to domestic violence victims. So I hope we use that opportunity long after the pandemic is over.
So that constant level of stress that's sort of always there that we're all feeling right now, Scott, you're saying that's what domestic violence victims feel all the time.
Right, and we're able to take a look at that and hopefully develop a greater sense of empathy and compassion rather than what we've often done in societies, which is engage in a lot of victim blame. We don't see what they're going through. We're not in their house. And we're very judgmental often of how victims deal with their situations. Now we get to see what it's like when we're all in danger to some extent.
I'd like to take a call. This is Terry in Philadelphia calling in. Hi, Terry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I have two questions, but first I'd like to say that I've worked with Lynn Shillette and her team both in New Hampshire and in Illinois. And so New Hampshire is very fortunate to have such an exemplary leader in this field, a national leader, in fact. My two questions are this. Are there any issues related to advocates themselves dealing with becoming infected and therefore reducing the numbers of folks that are available to help victims? How is that special subset being addressed? And two, are you in New Hampshire seeing any issues where courts are reluctant in light of COVID to be handling or fast-tracking emergency hearings?
Wow, great questions, Terry, and thank you very much for calling in. And Lynn, I'll throw that first one to you, advocates becoming infected. Some people are still going out and doing the work. Jen is still running her shelter. So go ahead, Lynn.
Absolutely. I think this looks a little bit different on a statewide level and on a local level. So maybe Jen wants to talk about the local piece. But what we're doing for the coalition staff, first and foremost, and we encouraged our programs to do it, is to adapt our policies to recognize that staff are being asked, at the same time that they are doing these incredibly challenging jobs, many, many staff members also have additional caretaking responsibilities at home, maybe caring for a parent or homeschooling their children, which is equally important. So we're adapting our leave policies and trying to be flexible and supportive so that people can stay safe with their families. We're also trying to make sure that staff in our office have resources to work remotely and the flexibility to work when they need to work. And also recognizing that this is an incredibly stressful environment for anyone responding to people in crises. So we're looking at all of those things. But Jen, I know there are other things you're putting in place, particularly in terms of responding to the shelter.
Well, right. And I wanted to ask you that, Jen. I mean, can you really practice social distancing at a shelter?
It's incredibly difficult. Communal living, there is no way to practice social distancing. Our shelter has 21 beds, and each bedroom, we have 7 bedrooms. That's their only private space. Everything else is communal living, from kitchen to laundry room to living room to kids' playroom. It's hard to social distance in that environment. As far as staffing goes, I'm the only one that is going into shelter at this point. I do have a number of staff that have commitments to children at home and have their own personal reasons for not going into the shelter at this time, and I'm very respectful of that. So I go in, I check on everybody, I deliver mail, food, and I wear my mask and check in on everyone. But, you know, it's important that staff is taking care of themselves too. And for that reason, we only have one person going in and out.
Wow. So what happens, Jen, if someone in your shelter and you're at capacity develops COVID-19 from the coronavirus?
Yeah. Great question. At this point, we are taking pretty extreme measures to make sure that doesn't happen. Folks are staying in and not leaving the house unless they have to. We have had community members that have been fantastic and just donated everything that they could possibly need so that they don't have to go out to the stores. We're doing check-ins with them daily to make sure everybody's feeling okay and doing okay. In the event that there was an outbreak in the shelter, I think we'd have to cross that bridge when we came to it. We would potentially have to close the shelter, but we would still house everyone off-site.
Sure. Given the hotel money that's now available.
Correct.
You mentioned earlier. So Terry, great questions. And we will address your court questions after a short break. So stay with us. We will address that coming up in just a moment. I also want to let listeners know that if someone you know needs help, the 24-hour domestic violence hotline is 866-644-3574. Let me give that again, 866-644-3574. And someone will be there to answer your questions, to connect you with resources. Speaking of resources, we have a ton on our website today, nhpr.org/exchange. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, adults in domestic abuse situations and efforts to support victims within the constraints of a public health crisis. Let's hear from you. If you're concerned about someone in your life who might be facing abuse during this pandemic, what questions do you have for our guests? Send them my email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can call in 1-800 800-282-6477. We have three guests, Lynn Cholette, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, Scott Hampton, Director of Ending the Violence, and Jennifer Pearson, Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire, which runs a shelter and provides other supports. And all of you, just before the break, we got a great comment from Terry, who, even though lives in Philadelphia, seems to work a lot in New Hampshire. And Terry asked about the criminal justice system in terms of domestic abuse. And Lynn, I'll throw this to you first, but anybody else jump in. What happens with some of the typical court protections, such as restraining orders, protective orders, emergency hearings, and so forth? What's going on with that, Lynn?
So there have been pretty significant changes to our court system in New Hampshire, which folks may have read about in the media. Many, many court hearings have been suspended or delayed. However, the Supreme Court has made some very specific exceptions related to victims of domestic violence and victims of stalking in particular. Victims are still able to file protective orders. And one of the changes that has happened very quickly is that those fillable forms are now available on the court website. And advocates should still be able to attend a hearing with a victim. If a victim already has an order that would have expired prior to the end of the governor's stay-at-home order, that order is automatically extended by the court system until after that stay-at-home order is lifted. So, you know, it's not a perfect situation, but I do appreciate that the courts have recognized the specific safety issues for victims of stalking and domestic violence and continued to make those remedies available and accessible.
Wow, there's a lot to keep track of. And some of these documents are so important in these processes to get people to safety. And it sounds like, Lynn, you're saying it's still happening, but not the way it used to.
That's right. And many other kinds of cases are not moving forward. And several of the other folks on the show have referred to some of the challenges around family law and custody cases. And those are not being expedited in the same way. And so that is creating extreme stressors for parents, for non-offending parents who are hoping to keep their children safe. So it's difficult. It's a very difficult situation. But I think what we want to make sure that victims know is that help is still available. The courts are open for emergency orders. Hospitals are still providing forensic evidence collection and medical care. And trained advocates at crisis centers throughout the state are still available, even if it's by phone, to talk to victims about these processes and how they can access these remedies.
And again, the hotline is 866-644-3574. There's a lot more information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. As we talk about court orders and so forth, Scott, what about guns and the potential for abuse to turn to murder? We've heard these stories before. What have you heard about background checks and whether they're increasing at this time of increased concern about domestic violence?
Well, the area that concerns me the most, there's a process that we use in New Hampshire that law enforcement uses in conjunction with the crisis centers, and it's called the Lethality Assessment Program. And what that is that when an officer responds to a potential domestic violence call, they do a screening to see whether or not, or to gauge the level of danger that the domestic violence victim is in. And it's a tool that was developed by Jackie Campbell down in Maryland, and it's a well-researched tool called the Danger Assessment Tool. And if the person screens and is being in a high level of danger, there's a phone call made by the police officer to the crisis center to try and connect the victim up with services. The reason I mention that is that there on that screening tool, there are a few items that are considered especially risky, And one of those is the ownership or access to weapons, whether or not the gun has ever been used as a threat against the other person's life. The reason this is so important is that some of Dr. Campbell's research has shown that merely owning or possessing a weapon increases the risk of lethality to the domestic violence victim, again, even if it's never been used as a threat. What's happened in COVID is the number of people who have been going out purchasing weapons has increased dramatically. So even if there's no direct connection, I'm going to go buy a gun so I can kill my partner. That's not necessary. If I go out and buy that gun and I'm in a situation where I've been abusive to my partner and we're in a situation where I have access to her 24/7 because we're both stay at home, her risk of dying increases by many fold. And one of the ways people have explained why it's so dangerous just having an access to a gun is that all it takes is a little twitch of the finger to end someone's life. It doesn't take a lot of thought or a lot of planning to engage in a lethal attack. So I'm very, very concerned about how the access to weapons and the access to victims and the additional stressors are all coming together in sort of a perfect storm.
Well, and Lynn, you mentioned earlier filing for protective orders and how many of the regular court procedures have either migrated online or have slowed down. What if people don't have access to the internet? Not only maybe they live in an area where the access isn't great, or maybe they no longer have access because of their domestic situation. How does somebody file for a protective order online if they don't have access online?
Then they should definitely connect with their local crisis center. The crisis center in their area will be able to help them access the forms and give them guidance on how their individual court would accept those forms. So connecting to the crisis center is always a great first place to go.
And again, connecting by regular old phone, if possible, or accessing public Wi-Fi. Somebody talked earlier in our first hour about, you know, homeless teenagers hang out at Dunkin' Donuts because they can use the public Wi-Fi there. So is that what you're talking about, Lynn?
Absolutely. Just calling the crisis center. The crisis centers, you know, one of the things that has become so clear in this COVID crisis is we always knew that crisis centers were innovative, were scrappy, were victim-centered, were resourceful, figured things out every single day on behalf of survivors. And what I see the crisis centers doing now is just rising to the occasion, and they will figure it out with a survivor, whether they need short-term housing tonight, whether they need money for groceries for their kids for this afternoon, or whether they need how to get that form and get it to the courthouse. I have 100% faith in the advocates around this state that they will figure it out.
Well, and again, that crisis number, 866-644-3574, 866-644-3574. Jen, how are the residents at your shelter feeling right now, given the constraints of the coronavirus, given that they're already, in a very stressful situation?
They're scared. I mean, they're human beings. They are going through a lot of trauma and processing that trauma of their own personal situations and a pandemic on top of that. It's incredibly difficult. I like to go with the one day at a time method with them because if we think about it, you know, 1 month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, it's just too overwhelming. And we just have to do this one day at a time. And a lot of them are disappointed that they're not meeting goals. We're very goal-centered. But how can you meet goals when the entire world is shut down right now? So we just work with them and talk with them and make sure that they know that this isn't them failing at anything. There's no way to meet goals right now. And we're here for them, and we're going to do this one day at a time right along with them.
Well, let's take another call. This is Eric in Nashua. And Eric, thank you for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Given the data that exists with law enforcement domestic violence at 40% compared to general population at 16%, what is being done to make sure that the law enforcement community and their families are being safe, not only from the coronavirus, but the domestic violence incidences that are related to the stresses that's inducing?
Oh, Eric, I'm so glad you called. And we've talked about this in other shows in the past. I'm really glad you raised it. Scott, just enlighten us there. Eric is right. There's added stress on our law enforcement, and sometimes that can lead to domestic violence.
Yeah, and we find that with law enforcement, we find that with military, we find that in the legal profession, and I think the larger message is that as pervasive as by the term the pandemic is, this is affecting everyone. Everyone is having increased levels of stress, having all the strategies that we normally fall back on in terms of, well, if you need some help, you know, go visit a neighbor, go visit a friend, go. There are so many of the strategies that are only available just aren't there. So we need to become very creative in how we do this, and we need to offer supports to everyone. So one of the things that we've talked a lot about today is about how we offer the supports to victims. The other thing we need to do is we need to offer support to the potential abusers as well. So one of the things that we're doing in our program is making sure that even if there are times when we can't meet with them face-to-face in a group because of the stay-at-home, we're still doing outreach with them. And so the support that we're offering is a little bit different in terms of it's not how to avoid being abused by someone else, but it's how to continue to make healthy choices and how to find a way to own our own struggles, get the help that we need so that we're not placing other people in danger. So I think it's an excellent point.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you called, Eric. So, Scott, how would you advise someone who, you know, is friendly with or related to a police family that might be feeling additional stress in this time? What should those loved ones watch out for if they have a concern?
I think it starts with a conversation. If they know people who are in that situation, even though we can't have face-to-face contact, we can still make phone calls, we can still text, we can still email. And a simple outreach just says, you know, this is a really difficult time for all of us. I wonder how you're doing. And one of the things I think is true for law enforcement and a lot of similar professions is that it's not natural necessarily for a police officer or someone in the military to reach out for help. And I think we need to send the message that it's okay to do that. That it's not a sign of weakness for people to say, you know, I'm scared. I need help. I need support. I need some connection. And so I think we need to reach out to those people and let them know that even though they're, I don't like the term social distancing, because I don't think we need a social distance. I think we need a physical distance. And so I think we need to reach out and say, I'm still here for you.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. And I've heard more people using that term, physical distancing. Jen, last question for you, please. And it relates to what Eric said. What would you say to loved ones, family, friends, coworkers, who might have a concern about a person who might be being abused? What should the rest of us watch out for?
I think it's important to know that we as crisis centers statewide, we're not just here for the victims. We're also here for those that are impacted by the abuse. So if you think that somebody that you love is being abused, you can call us. And you can call us anonymously. We can talk you through it. We can give you red flags. We can let you know, validate your feelings that this is real. This is happening to your loved one. And we can give you support around how to support your loved one through the situation that they're in.
Well, Jennifer Pearson, we will let you go. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer Pearson, Executive Director of the Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire. And last question for you too, Scott. What are your hopes for how our state, our society will address this issue once we have hopefully moved past this virus?
Yeah, what I think my I have a very long list, but at the top of the list is I hope that what we do is we realize that some of these restrictions now, these stay at home or inability to get some of our needs met, some of these restrictions have always been in place for victims. So victims with disabilities, victims who have a stalker in their lives, they've been having these restrictions for years. They've had it for their entire relationship. So I'm hoping that what this will do is give us an opportunity to see, to do a better job of identifying, understanding, and responding to victims long past hopefully the soon end of this pandemic.
It's the compassion that you talked about earlier, Scott.
Right.
Well, Scott, thank you very much also for giving us your time today. We really appreciate it. We'll talk again.
Okay.
That was Scott Hampton. He's director of Ending the Violence, based in Dover, operating statewide. And Lynn, just to wrap it up with you too, please, this has been an especially tough time for the people that you work with. What positive developments are you looking at?
I think one of the biggest positive developments is how crisis centers and the coalition and our supporters and our boards and our volunteers have pulled together with such a focus and emphasis on our mission. I think that day in and day out, we are watching staff and volunteers go above and beyond to get information out to the crisis centers, to get information out to the media, to get information out to legislators about what is needed, and about the fact that there are ways that people can get involved and people can help. We will only end sexual and domestic violence when we approach it as a full community. And we welcome the partnerships with our communities to make that happen.
Well, Lynn, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Lynn Cholette, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Again, listeners, if you or someone you know needs help, you can call the 24-hour domestic violence hotline at 866-644-3574. Again, 866-644-3574. And as always, you can find much more information at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.